Tales from the Jazz Age by F. Scott Fitzgerald. May Day. Chapter 9. Childs, 59th Street, at 8 o'clock of any morning, differs from its sisters by less than the width of their marble tables or the degree of polish on the frying pans. You will see there a crowd of poor people with sleep in the corners of their eyes, trying to look straight before them at their food so as not to see the other poor people. But Childs, 59th, 4 hours earlier, is quite unlike any Childs restaurant from Portland, Oregon to Portland, Maine. Within its pale but sanitary walls, one finds a noisy medley of chorus girls, college boys, debutantes, rakes, filles de joie, a not unrepresentative mixture of the gayest of Broadway and even of Fifth Avenue. In the early morning of May, the 2nd, it was unusually full. Over the marble-topped tables were bent the excited faces of flappers, whose fathers owned individual villages. They were eating buckwheat cakes and scrambled eggs with relish and gusto, an accomplishment that it would have been utterly impossible for them to repeat in the same place 4 hours later. Almost the entire crowd were from the Gamma Psi dance at Delmonico's, except for several chorus girls from a midnight review who sat at a side table and wished they'd taken off a little more makeup after the show. Here and there, a drab, mouse-like figure, desperately out of place, watched the butterflies with a weary, puzzled curiosity. But the drab figure was the exception. This was the morning after May Day, and celebration was still in the air. Gus Rose, sober but a little dazed, must be classed as one of the drab figures. How he had got himself from 44th Street to 59th Street after the riot was only a hazy half-memory. He had seen the body of Carol Key put in an ambulance and driven off, and then he had started uptown with two or three soldiers. Somewhere between 44th Street and 59th Street, the other soldiers had met some women and disappeared. Rose had wandered to Columbus Circle and chosen the gleaming lights of Childs to minister to his craving for coffee and doughnuts. He walked in and sat down. All around him floated airy, inconsequential chatter and high-pitched laughter. At first, he failed to understand, but after a puzzled 5 minutes, he realized that this was the aftermath of some gay party. Here and there, a restless, hilarious young man wandered fraternally and familiarly between the tables, shaking hands indiscriminately, and pausing occasionally for a facetious chat, while excited waiters bearing cakes and eggs aloft swore at him silently and bumped him out of the way. To Rose, seated at the most inconspicuous and least crowded table, the whole scene was a colorful circus of beauty and riotous pleasure. He became gradually aware, after a few moments, that the couple seated diagonally across from him with their backs to the crowd were not the least interesting pair in the room. The man was drunk. He wore a dinner coat with a disheveled tie and shirt swollen by spillings of water and wine. His eyes, dim, bloodshot, roved unnaturally from side to side. His breath came short between his lips. "He's been on a spree," thought Rose. The woman was almost, if not quite, sober. She was pretty, with dark eyes and feverish high color, and she kept her active eyes fixed on her companion with the alertness of a hawk. From time to time she would lean and whisper intently to him, and he would answer by inclining his head heavily or by a particularly ghoulish and repellent wink. Rose scrutinized them dumbly for some minutes until the woman gave him a quick, resentful look. Then he shifted his gaze to two of the most conspicuously hilarious of the promenaders who were on a protracted circuit of the tables. To his surprise, he recognized in one of them the young man by whom he had been so ludicrously entertained at Delmonico's. This started him thinking of Key with a vague sentimentality, not unmixed with awe. Key was dead. He had fallen 35 feet and split his skull like a cracked coconut. "He was a darn good guy," thought Rose mournfully. "He was a darn good guy, all right. That was awful hard luck about him." The two promenaders approached and started down between Rose's table and the next, addressing friends and strangers alike with jovial familiarity. Suddenly, Rose saw the fair-haired one with the prominent teeth stop, look unsteadily at the man and girl opposite, and then begin to move his head disapprovingly from side to side. The man with the bloodshot eyes looked up. "Gordy," said the promenader with the prominent teeth. "Gordy." "Hello," said the man with the stained shirt thickly. Prominent teeth shook his finger pessimistically at the pair, giving the woman a glance of aloof condemnation. "What'd I tell you, Gordy?" Gordon stirred in his seat. "Go to hell," he said. Dean continued to stand there, shaking his finger. The woman began to get angry. "You go away," she cried fiercely. "You're drunk, that's what you are."
"So's he,"
suggested Dean, staying the motion of his finger and pointing it at Gordon. Peter Himmel ambled up, owlish now and oratorically inclined.
"Here now,"
he began, as if called upon to deal with some petty dispute between children.
"What's all the trouble?"
"You take your friend away," said Jewel tartly. "He's bothering us."
"What's that?"
"You heard me," she said shrilly. "I said to take your drunken friend away." Her rising voice rang out above the clatter of the restaurant, and a waiter came hurrying up.
"You gotta be more quiet."
"That fella's drunk," she cried. "He's insulting us."
"Aha! Gordy,"
persisted the accused.
"What'd I tell you?"
He turned to the waiter.
"Gordy and I are friends. Been trying to help him, haven't I, Gordy?"
Gordy looked up.
"Help me? Hell no."
Jewel rose suddenly, and seizing Gordon's arm, assisted him to his feet. "Come on, Gordy," she said, leaning toward him and speaking in a half-whisper. "Let's us get out of here. This fella's got a mean drunk on." Gordon allowed himself to be urged to his feet and started toward the door. Jewel turned for a second and addressed the provoker of their flight.
"I know all about you," she said fiercely. "Nice friend you are, I'll say. He told me about you."
Then she seized Gordon's arm, and together they made their way through the curious crowd, paid their check, and went out.
"You'll have to sit down," said the waiter to Peter after they had gone.
"What's that?"
"Sit down."
"Yes, or get out."
Peter turned to Dean.
"Come on," he suggested. "Let's beat up this waiter."
"All right."
They advanced toward him, their faces grown stern. The waiter retreated. Peter suddenly reached over to a plate on the table beside him and, picking up a handful of hash, tossed it into the air. It descended as a languid parabola in snowflake effect on the heads of those nearby.
"Hey, ease up! Put him out!"
"Sit down, Peter. Cut out that stuff."
Peter laughed and bowed.
"Thank you for your kind applause, ladies and gents. If someone will lend me some more hash and a tall hat, we will go on with the act."
The bouncer bustled up.
"You got to get out," he said to Peter.
"Hell no."
"He's my friend,"
put in Dean indignantly. A crowd of waiters were gathering.
"Put him out."
"Better go, Peter."
There was a short struggle, and the two were edged and pushed toward the door.
"I got a hat and coat here," cried Peter. "Well, go get him and be spry about it."
The bouncer released his hold on Peter, who, adopting a ludicrous air of extreme cunning, rushed immediately around to the other table, where he burst into derisive laughter and thumbed his nose at the exasperated waiters.
"Think I'd just better wait a little longer," he announced.
The chase began. Four waiters were sent around one way and four another. Dean caught hold of two of them by the coat, and another struggle took place before the pursuit of Peter could be resumed. He was finally pinioned after overturning a sugar bowl and several cups of coffee. A fresh argument ensued at the cashier's desk, where Peter attempted to buy another dish of hash to take with him and throw at policemen. But the commotion upon his exit proper was dwarfed by another phenomenon, which drew admiring glances and a prolonged involuntary, "Oh!" from every person in the restaurant. The great plate-glass front had turned to a deep blue, the color of a Maxfield Parish moonlight, a blue that seemed to press close upon the pane as if to crowd its way into the restaurant. Dawn had come up in Columbus Circle, magical, breathless. Dawn had come up in Columbus Circle, magical, breathless dawn, silhouetting the great statue of the immortal Christopher and mingling in a curious and uncanny manner with the fading yellow electric light inside. The end of Chapter 9 of May Day, as originally published in Tales from the Jazz Age by F. Scott Fitzgerald. Read by Rick Kistner for Let to Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.